Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 8th day of May. It is a Thursday, and it's 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. An absolute delight to have you with us on this day. All week I've been looking. I go into the magic refrigerated bag I have of I have to put it into like a shopping bag because otherwise people steal my soda. But I mean, they don't steal. Yeah, I know. I certainly don't want to. You know. Point fingers at any of my coworkers. But anyway,
looking at you, Ray Graff.
Monday was homies. So they have names on them now. You know, you can get a Rich bottle. You can get a Judy bottle. I don't know if they have an Ira bottle.
No.
I think they have. But then when you buy like the six packs, it's more general things. So it was homies. And then on Tuesday, it was pals. Wednesday, again, was homies. Today is the OG. And we in the studio were trying to figure out what OG stood for. Bo came up with old...
Original group.
So when I looked it up, it's original gangster.
Yeah, even I knew that.
but doesn't that seem like an odd thing to put on a Coke bottle?
It all did. It all sounds like cultural appropriation to me.
Well, you're not wrong. You're absolutely right. I guess it's not very far from homies, is it?
Yeah.
No, yeah, that's true. Today, share a Coke with
the original gangster.
The original gangster. There we go. All right. Good morning, all. Welcome, and we welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group, and we will get started. Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin is here. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. Thanks for having me back.
Really nice to have you here. We're lucky to have you join us, and I'm thrilled that you're here again today. Ira Fussfeld is here, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, and dear friend. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Good morning, Joe and everyone. I'm okay, or as Rodney would say, I'm okay now, but last week I was in rough shape.
We have an interview coming up with a guy who did a biography on Rodney Dangerfield, and I've been reading about Rodney Dangerfield, and that's a story. 45 years old before he got his big break, which was a slot on the Ed Sullivan Show, and then it was another 5 years before he got on Carson, and then his career
was he Jackie Roy then?
Yeah, Jack Roy, yeah. and then changed it to Rodney Dangerfield, and it was some club owner in like Montana who changed his name. It was like, yeah, how about Rodney Dangerfield? So remember Rover Dangerfield, that movie? Anyone remember that?
I don't.
He did an animated movie where he would play like a hound dog that wore a red tie, and he never got any respect. It was great. That'll be coming up. We'll hear that interview in the days to come. Thank you for bringing it to a halt, Ira. I appreciate it. I know it was my fault, but thank you. You know how to get me. Corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle, LLP, Rich Honan is here. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
Really nice to see you as well. And Judy Patrick joins us, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, former title, and good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I am great. Nice to be here.
Really nice to have you here. Great group. A lot to talk about. Busy day. We'll get started and find out what is on your mind as we go forward. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. So is this new?
No, this
the
is
way
old.
It's, this is
third black
screen. Okay, we're looking for the we were looking at the what's happening at the Vatican, but And then they're going to vote again in about an hour, right? Is that the is that the story? So black smoke for the third time, and then the fourth vote will.
Well, I have a question. As somebody who's not Catholic and does, only knows the
ask Rich.
we were talking papal things. Well,
the more votes there are suggests that they can't come to a decision. Does that weaken or make the ultimate winner look less of a powerful figure than he might have been if it was clear cut?
I think once you're Pope, you're Pope. I mean, you know, meaning that takes over for all.
Right.
That trumps
but
everything.
Do people not think less of the Pope if it's taken 12 votes to get there?
Well, Rich is reading some opus on the papacy. Has there ever been
a great book.
A first vote decision that, as far as I know, you haven't completed the book yet.
I'm sure there has, actually.
I think I read that there was
the shortest one
fairly recently.
Yeah. By the way, the book, if you want to read about it, there's a book called Absolute Monarchs. It is very thick and very dense, and it basically goes through every pope, starting with St. Peter. But no, my understanding is that once you're elected, at that moment you become infallible, and everyone just follows.
Well, and I'm... Obviously, a lot of people saw this in the movie Conclave, but there is that understanding that there are the different factions, and as they start working and dealing and people start, maybe they even thought initially, well, this is probably how this is going to end up, but we have to go through the machinations before it does. So
yeah, and apparently the first round there's like a significant amount of kind of favorite son votes.
Yes.
You know, people who just get a vote because either they like them or, you know.
Who picked Alfred E. Newman?
From the great state of...
Yeah, I was just going to say that. From the great state of Italy.
So we're just watching that. And
no Pope yet.
No Pope yet. Okay. Well, we'll be on Pope Watch. Rich, we'll put you in charge of
Thank
that.
You.
So please let us know. And if you see any smoke, please let us know immediately. All right. I want to remind you that it's Listener Appreciation Week. And, you know, if you're an old gangster and or an original gangster,
original
gangster and love this station, then we love you right back. And we wouldn't be here without you. There's a series of conversations that we've been having with longtime listeners and they talk about what the station means to them, and they're really fun to listen to. We'll hear one this morning about 10 o'clock, but they're fascinating to hear what folks have to say about the station. So, you know, we're having, you know, public media is having a tough time right now. We our future is somewhat uncertain as to funding, and we need help, and we need support, and we need your back, and you've always had it. You've always had our back, and we hope that that is still the case this time around. If you'd like to help us out, we'd love for you to do so, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We'll hear some of these testimonials and these conversations, these appreciations as we celebrate Listener Appreciation Week. And just a reminder that, we need whatever we can get right now to make this station very secure and give it the backing that it needs and I believe deserves. So WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. Let's go to the news of the day, and we start with the Libya deportations and the somewhat complicated story because there was a warning yesterday from a judge who warned the Trump administration against deportations to Libya. The stern order followed reports indicating the U.S. was poised to send a plane load of immigrants to the troubled African nation, then made further interesting by the fact that Libya said, well, we weren't going to take them in the first place, so there's that. But a federal judge warned the Trump administration that it cannot deport immigrants to Libya, Saudi Arabia, and any other country where they are not citizens without due process. saying such a move would violate standing court orders intended to shield people from being expelled to countries where they could be harmed or killed. U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy in Boston writing in a swift, stern response to an emergency request from lawyers for a number of immigrants said he had already barred the Department of Homeland Security from deporting someone to a third country without having given them a chance to challenge the removal and seek protection in the United States. Lawyers representing immigrants with final deportation orders as part of a class action lawsuit against the Trump administration had asked Murphy for the emergency order on Wednesday after reports indicated that U.S. immigration officers were preparing to deport people from Vietnam, Laos, and Philippines to Libya. The troubled North African nation is, quote, notorious for its human rights violations, especially with respect to migrant residents, according to the emergency motion. If there is any doubt, the court sees none. The allegedly imminent removals, as reported by news agencies and as plaintiffs seek to corroborate the class member accounts and public information, would clearly violate the court's order, Justice Murphy wrote in his decision. That from the Washington Post. Bo Breslin, we'll go to you first.
Joe, I think this is an extraordinarily complicated situation from both the domestic and international.
I just need you to move your mic and then just bring it up just a little bit. There we go. Perfect. Yes, you've been fitted.
So I think it's an extraordinarily complicated situation for a number of reasons, both domestically and internationally. So let me go through them quickly and get some stuff on the table and we can talk about it. Domestically, it's the standoff again between the Trump administration and the judiciary at some level, but made a little bit more complicated by the timing of Chief Justice Roberts' statement yesterday that or his conversation where he talked about the excesses of the executive branch and the Congress, and the point of the judiciary is to be a guardrail against those excesses. So that's part of the complication. There are also, you know, treaties and so on that prevent folks from being deported to places like Libya. So I think there is a sort of a complication from the domestic level. On the international level, it's even more complicated because of where they're going, right? So Libya serves a couple of purposes for the Trump administration. One is, you know, what do Americans think about when they think about Libya? They think, if they're our generation, they think about Gaddafi.
Right.
Perfectly appropriate and strategically important move for the Trump administration to frighten potential immigrants that they might be going to what was at one time the most autocratic and tyrannical regime probably on the planet under Gaddafi, who was there for 40-some-odd years. But you also have some of the other stories. What does the more recent generation think about when they think about Libya? It's probably Benghazi, right, where it was the most embarrassing or one of the most embarrassing moments for the Obama administration. Ron Johnson, senator from Wisconsin, confronts Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton says, "What difference does it make? Four people were dead." You know, and the Susan Rice hiding of whether or not, you know, sort of the information that led to the death of Chris Stevens, the ambassador in Benghazi. You have Arab Spring in neighboring Tunisia. Arab Spring was peaceful in Libya. The Arab Spring even eventually required U.S. bombs and bullets. So you have all of these factors playing a role, and I'll throw one more into the mix. In Europe, Libya has a certain label with regard to migration. 163,000 migrants moved from Libya to Malta and Italy in 2017, and it's sort of seen as this. Libya is seen as this place in which we've got to resist migration in Europe. So in Europe, Libya is even more of a bigger deal. There's just a lot of complications beyond the domestic standoff between the judiciary and the Trump administration.
I'm also interested just in your thoughts, and I want to hear from everybody else, obviously. But the other thing that we mentioned yesterday, because we didn't talk about the court action, but we did talk about sending immigrants to Libya. But what also came up in that conversation is reporting from the Washington Post that indicated that part of the negotiations in Ukraine was also that they were looking to send to send people to Ukraine as well, which I mean, all of this seems to be of where we're sending them and why those particular places.
Yeah. So, you know, what do those countries have in common? Right. The El Salvador, Libya, Ukraine. I'll throw Rwanda in there as another place that's sort of floated around. They are relatively unstable. Now, Ukraine is a little bit different, but in light of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it's relatively unstable. It's economically, these countries are generally economically fragile up until what Zelensky's trying to do in Ukraine is more Europeanize Ukraine away from the sort of the Russian influence, eliminate corruption. But Ukraine was quite corrupt up until Zelensky came into play. So these countries have particular things in common that fulfill, I think, a lot of Trump strategic initiatives and ideas.
Rich Onan.
Oh, I wanted to hear what Judy and Ira said first.
Okay.
well, thanks. I'll be brief. I mean, I think.
Do you want my seat? Go ahead.
Bearing in mind what Bo just described, and he painted a broad picture, I'm still fixated on the process and the judiciary challenge that Trump again has laid out there, and has laid out there through all of his private and public life. He tries to push something as far as it can go, and he'll see what the courts say, and ultimately some of these may go to the Supreme Court. And that finally he will have pushed it as far as he can go, win, lose, or draw. But in the meantime, he'll stretch this thing out forever, and who knows what can happen in the absence of a definitive ruling. And it just but this is Trump. It's we've seen it before. We'll see it again. And I was impressed by the quotes that I read from the judge, who certainly was not taking suffering fools gladly.
Judy?
So this is just Trump. The strategy is to scare the bejesus out of all the immigrants in the country, or potential immigrants to the country, and also to tell his base that he's the meanest, baddest sheriff in town, and he's going to send people to the scariest countries in the world.
The original gangster.
and whether or not he has any idea of the backstory of Libya, I seriously question. I don't think he, I mean, he might recognize the word Benghazi, but I think he's just picking out scary places, and Stephen Miller saying, yeah, that's scary. Let's see if we can send people there. It's just, this is all messaging.
Yeah, I don't.
You ready, Rich?
First, when I read, I don't understand. There's so much about the story I don't understand. First, I think there's about 11 more important stories going on in the world, but we could talk about this. Just from a legal perspective, this was an order, an emergency order that was obtained based upon a rumor. Or was there an actual action taken by the administration? Or was, we hear that the White House is going to do this, and they went into court. Did the Department of Justice oppose it?
Like my understanding, and I don't know if this is accurate, and please, anyone who has other
information. It was hard to tell.
My understanding was that that this came from, that the lawyers were notified, the lawyers of those who were going to be deported were notified that they were leaving at such a time and they were going to Libya.
By their clients they were notified, or by the administration?
I assume either their clients were notified by the administration, or they were notified by the administration. But it's a great point. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Rich, I think my sense is that it resembled what had happened in Texas when the folks went to El Salvador.
So right.
That moment where you're like, oh, you're getting close to the plane. Let's get an injunction.
Yeah, and And I don't disagree. There's clearly the Trump administration, this is no surprise, is trying very hard to message that if we believe you are here illegally, we're going to take extraordinary measures to deport you. I think that's clearly true, and I agree that I didn't understand the Libya connection at all. Like I didn't. Is there actually a deal with Libya? Because the two rival factions who are fighting over Libya both said they're not coming here.
Right.
So from a judicial standpoint, I think that the judge might have walked into something here. And I'm not giving the Trump administration credit for having, you know, worked this out. But you're not really supposed to make a decision on something until there's an actual controversy. You know, that's a big judicial canon of kind of construction. There are times when you can get a declaratory judgment, but this was like a preliminary injunction based upon a rumor of something they think might happen, and I think it might be now that this will be a very, very weak case for all of those who are trying to make the argument that, yes, a district court judge does have this kind of power. I think this is going to play badly, and I think it's going to be helpful to the people who are trying to limit the kind of nationwide power of district court judges, because it's really odd for a judge to make a decision where I can't really point to the administrative action.
Right.
So.
What does it have to – I mean, it's, yes, it has something to do with power, but at the end of the day, we're talking about a process – by which our Constitution has empowered the judiciary to interpret the Constitution vis-a-vis whatever it is that's in front of them, and it should not be a political decision. It's supposed to be an interpretive decision that was put in the laps of the judiciary by the founding fathers, and Trump et al. are challenging it and trying to see if they can avoid having to answer to this judicial branch.
So I think that's true. Ira, I think that's true. But Rich is right. At some level, this is a little premature, what the judge did. I think the Libya connection, Rich, is easy. As Judy said, it's all about frightening folks. And is there a country that you can point to that has the same level of, level of fright than Libya, at least among our generation, probably not.
No, I don't disagree with that. I was just saying, is somebody telling me there's a proposed deal in place, like between the administration and Libya? Because it sure doesn't sound that way.
Well, I think that.
But I agree, it's a frightening prospect. And I also agree with Judy that I think that might have been the point of the whole, you know, of dropping the whole rumor, you know, if it was a rumor.
True, but I this is my cynical side, and I'll stop here. My cynical side says just because. Unofficially or officially, the Libyan government comes out and says, we don't have an agreement, your people are not coming here, doesn't mean that there isn't some negotiations happening behind the scene or dollars, right? So money went to El Salvador. And so in a corrupt, quite frankly, a massively corrupt government like Libya, that those dollars will mean something. And especially, I was reading earlier today, there was almost $1 billion worth of aid that went to Libya, most of which came from Europe. In the U.S., there was $100 million programs canceled by USAID to Libya, which funds the corrupt government. I'm sure they're looking for ways to pad the pockets.
This also reflects the circumstances in which the undocumented people were sent to El Salvador so quickly that the courts couldn't act fast enough. And it was a case in which, you know, it's too late, and they're stuck.
The planes
there.
In the air that were going.
Right. Yeah. And so the courts in that case didn't act as quickly as they should have. Maybe there's some sort of rule that needs to be put in place from a legal perspective where things don't happen until people have a chance to voice their concerns and make their case.
Well, I'm sure that argument, I'm not sure. I would guess that exact argument was made in the case we're talking about, because I'm sure the first thing the judge said, again, I'm not sure, but I would guess the first thing that the judge said was, show me the order. Show me what is it that we're fighting about here. And then, you know, they say, no, this is what we're being told. And when the judge says, well, there's nothing for me to act on, I can understand them making the argument that, well, there wasn't anything for the last guy to act on either. And, you know, the administration admitted that they sent somebody to the wrong place. So I think that did play in. I don't think it provides a strong case for, you know, Bo, what you were talking about providing power or Ira to the, you know, to the individual federal judges in a district. I mean, that they're supposed to have full jurisdiction over the parties to the action, but usually, increasingly over the last 20 years, the parties to an action are people saying, we're bringing this action on behalf of everybody in the country who is so affected, you know? And I think that's where the arguments of overreach stem from.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. And you can do that right now. You can also help out our fundraising as we move forward and try to secure this radio station and make sure that our funding is secure. WAMC.org, WAMC.org to help us out. We'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this eighth day of May, 42 minutes past 9 o'clock. We are talking about deportation and a judge warning the Trump administration against Libya deportations, a stern ruling, as was said. White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller derided the judge's ruling. Another judge puts himself in charge of the Pentagon, he wrote on social media. This is a judicial coup. Asked about the reports of a deportation flight to Libya, President Donald Trump said he did not know about it and referred the reporter who asked the question to the Department of Homeland Security. The judge's orders come as the Trump administration attempts to fulfill the president's campaign promises to deport the largest number of immigrants in U.S. history. But advocates for immigrants allege that the government's tactics violate court orders as well as federal laws and put immigrants in danger. So my very pointed and silly question is this a judicial coup?
It's not a judicial coup. The case has been brought in front of a judge, and the judge has made a ruling on it. And if people disagree with the ruling, they can appeal it to the next level up. But when Stephen Miller throws around phrases like judicial coup, it'll resonate for people who are willing to accept that as their answer. And it's not going to do this country any good if people are going to judge what they read as a court decision as being a judicial coup.
And I'll just piggyback on that, Joe, and say one of the tactics of the Trump administration, and I'll say broadly they do it very well, is the idea of if you continue to have short, concise messages thrown out there repeatedly. This is not the first time Stephen Miller has said roughly that this is a judicial coup. He hasn't used that term, but he's said that the judiciary doesn't control the executive and so on. If you continue to do those short, concise, quippy messages out there, it starts to seep into the water. It starts to seep into the DNA, and it becomes part of the political landscape. They are very good at that in a way that Democrats, for example, are not so good.
Judy?
You know, it's true about the judiciary being under attack. I mean, after the Dobbs decision, liberals were very critical of the Supreme Court and questioning the credibility of the integrity of the court. I mean, you had very serious stories about the judges being partisan and getting lavish gifts and spending, you know, and so from that happens from the left. And I think criticism of court decisions has been a long-standing perspective from the conservative perspective. I can remember listening to Rush Limbaugh talking about it. But that's one of the reasons the conservatives have worked so hard. They recognize the fact that the judiciary is an important branch of government and tried to get people who believed in their values in an important judicial position. So I think we all need to step back and respect the rule of law and realize that it's a messy, complicated thing. These cases about, from an idealistic perspective, we should not be grabbing people off the street and sending them to countries for life sentences in harsh, brutal conditions who haven't been proven guilty of anything. And the idea that it's no longer coming after the worst of the worst when it comes to undocumented people in this country, it's everybody. If you don't have the documentation, that therefore you are breaking the law and you will be deported. Our country really hasn't had a conversation about that, and we really need to.
But these people have. I agree with pretty much everything you say. And by the way, Stephen Miller is just an idiot. Okay,
he's a dangerous idiot.
Yeah. But hopefully, at some point, he flames out. But the my understanding is, whether you agree or disagree with the process in this case, that these final deportation orders were granted as a result of judicial process, and they're all granted. Anybody who's got a final deportation order now, it had to have been granted during the Biden administration, right? I mean, so the initial I thought, what was it? There was 1 million people with final deportation order, and I know there's a technical term for it, but And that had been granted, and that's who allegedly, the Trump administration is working on first. So I think there was due process in that final decision. I think I would agree, Judy, that it's hard to say whether or not there was due process in the case we're talking about here, because I don't know what the decision was. I don't know if there was a decision.
Well, let's, Rich, let's assume you're right, and you probably are, that there were deportation orders prior to Trump taking over and that they were issued in by the Biden administration. What is complicated and what is probably troublesome for many of us is the idea that deportation to Mexico feels different than deportation to El Salvador and Libya.
It does.
And so when you're talking about, for example, when you're talking about due process may have been given to some of these folks prior to it with the assumption that they weren't going to go to some of the most horrific places, that mega prisons and so on. And the other thing that I'll throw in the mix is the Trump administration's ignoring UN treaties, right? There's a convention against torture that prohibits us from deporting anyone to countries that engage in cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. We sign that. That's not Mexico. That is Libya and El Salvador. So I think there's the due process takes on a higher level of urgency when you're going to the places that Trump wants to advertise he's sending them to.
Right. But we're no matter where they're going, though, there's still that concern over due process.
Absolutely.
And whether that's actually taking place.
At due process in the deportation, the original deportation decision, or what Beau's saying, which I think is legit, that maybe there needs to be another level of due process where suddenly the effect of the deportation decision is now very different from what you might have expected when that decision was made. I understand.
I'm going to go with the legit part.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no,
I have a choice between the two. I'm going to go with that.
I don't disagree with that. And look, there's no. It's and I certainly look. I don't agree with a lot of what the Trump administration does. They're clearly looking hard to pick fights, both with the judiciary and judicially. Because they, they're clearly trying to. I mean, the case of the guy who was sent to El Salvador after, I guess, one of the judges had said you could kind of go anywhere, but not El Salvador, and they sent him there. And you would think, just from a management standpoint, I mean, if that came across my desk, I'd say, all right, bring the guy back, and then send them wherever the hell we were supposed to send them. I would have tried to sidestep it and say, all right, you know, send them somewhere else. I think that's the other part of the problem is they're looking for these fights
by the way, when the summary that Joe was reading before where Trump claimed he was ignorant of whatever the issue was, I've heard him say this two or three times now in the last couple of days where reporters ask him a question and says, I don't know. Does anybody believe that he does not know everything that's not going on in his administration at a certain level? There's no way he doesn't know what this.
But what was there to know? First of all, he referred it. If I heard it right, he referred them to Homeland Security.
Yes,
Miller was
White House Deputy Chief of Staff.
He was talking about defense, right?
You know,
so they're not even talking about the same department to refer the questions to. I think it is possible in this case that it was something discussed, maybe at a high level. I don't know that it was a fully baked decision. I don't know that there was a decision. So I could see, you know, Trump saying, look, I don't know. But I don't trust it had the desired effect, if you believe Judy.
Trump could come in here to this studio, say hello to everybody, and say, tomorrow is Friday, and I wouldn't believe him.
But, I mean, it's also, to your point, another recent time in which he said, I don't know, is in the answer to the question of the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
So, yes.
I assume you guys had that fight back when he said it, right? And somebody pointed out that if you listen to the entire interview, what he said was, I don't know, I rely on the lawyers.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. No. And actually, we said, yeah, you would rely on the lawyers. I mean, yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's the way that it was. It's an odd way to start a sentence about the Constitution, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's just like, yes, I understand the point.
It's kind of a New York response, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Are you a Met fan? I don't know.
That's a good point. Roy says, your guest mentioned something about Libya and used the word frightening and said that they are a massively corrupt government. At first, I thought he was talking about Israel being frightening and incredibly corrupt, but no. I was just about to write asking if any of you have seen the many videos lately of things posted online by young IDF soldiers where they are giddy with joy looking at the camera as they toss hand grenades over a balcony onto a small displaced person's camp below. Our taxes are still paying for those grenades and for these sociopaths to continue making slaughter and genocide into TikTok videos. A lot going on in that letter, but there you go. James says it should be noted that while Trump is threatening to send undocumented immigrants who just so happen to have darker skin color to Libya, he is simultaneously granting U.S. access to white Afrikaners. Only the Trump faithful can not see this for what it is, open and obvious racism. This is what MAGA means to them. Then we go to this letter from Maureen. Stephen Miller knows that repeating a slogan imprints it in the consciousness. Let's try one for the rest of us. Solve the deficit and the debt. Tax the rich. It won't affect their lifestyles one bit. That from Maureen. Then we go to Kevin. Benghazi, what? Please explain. A chance to remind us that Hillary is evil? That's from Kevin.
That was well written and well read.
Yes. Thank you. Cecilia says, forgive my ignorance, but if someone comes to the United States illegally, aren't they supposed to be deported to their home country? I am bewildered by how it can be okay to send people seemingly arbitrarily to whatever country will take them.
Yeah, I actually don't know. I always thought that deported meant
you go back.
You get back to from whence you came.
Well, that's why they have. That's why the UN convention has said you can't send them to a third country. That's part of the reason.
But what happens if, to the point of should they just automatically be deported if they came here illegally? What happens if you pick up somebody down the street and say, you're here illegally, we're going to deport you, and in fact they were not here illegally, and they have a temporary visa, that's the whole point of the due process. You just can't send them back. You got to find out something about them to see if in fact they do belong at somewhere else.
Right, but these people had already been through that process if they had final deportation orders.
If they had final deportation orders, then yes. But if you walk down Central Avenue and you find somebody who you think is looks like somebody who ought to be deported,
right.
They need to be adjudicated.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
In the case of some of the people who went to El Salvador, I think Venezuela said they did not want them back. Yeah. So what do you do in that case when the home country will not take them back? You're people without a country.
John writes, Rich says, there are 10 more important stories you all could be talking about. A complaint I hear from some of my right-wing nut friends, no offense, Rich.
He said 11 stories.
Is that stories covered reflect the left-wing leanings. I wonder what the 10 are that Rich is thinking about.
I don't know. The war between Pakistan and India. I think I might start with that.
Yeah.
Israel taking over Gaza.
Which was our... We did both those stories yesterday. I understand.
Possible tariff deal with the UK that's been bandied about yesterday and today.
Yep.
I can name 8 more.
No, I know you could. And well done, actually.
The Knicks.
That said, let me pitch this story. I think this story, it goes back, Joe, I think, to the question you asked, which is, or the reader asked about, shouldn't folks who come into this country illegally get deported? And the answer is maybe at a theoretical level and at an aggregate level, but everybody has a story. And many of those stories are escaping oppression and tyranny in their country. And to what extent does and I sound like I'm Pollyannish, but I'm unabashedly liberal here. To what extent should the United States be the place that cradles those folks? I think we are a better country because we do that.
Yeah, I think we all agree with that. I think one of the arguments is that traditionally, that type of sanctuary was not the bulk of our immigration population. That the people were coming traditionally, people were coming from from Ireland and Italy and building the country. And while we all agree that there needs to be room for sanctuary, the argument on our side, on the right wing side, is that if you're going to take the position that everybody who lives in a place worse than America is entitled to come to America, there's just not enough infrastructure to do that. I very much agree. I think any place in the world that you live other than here could very well be a much worse place, especially a lot of the countries that we're talking about here. But if that becomes the only criteria, from a logistics standpoint, we can't do that. And second, you reach a point where maybe that's not as good for the prospects of the United States. I mean, we all want there to be room for sanctuary. I think it's been, the argument is that the Biden administration and previous administrations abused that.
Two more letters and then we'll go to a break. One, Beth says, you, the media, are playing right into Trump's hands again. Almost every day he says something outrageous and you all run to cover it. Well, in fairness to us, it was the judge's order that we were talking about, not what Trump said, but just there's that point.
So would the writer not want to know what Trump said, if it's outrageous?
I guess that was sort
then
of the,
what?
Yeah, and then what, exactly. In keeping with Joe's opening concern, writes Susan, I thought I would share this, a Pope joke.
Good transition.
What does the Pope like to drink? Pope C. Cola.
Oh. Yeah, nice. Yeah.
Happy Wednesday, friends.
I told the group off air there was something on the internet yesterday with a picture of the late Pope and then the picture of Trump in the Pope regalia. And the caption was, Pope, dope.
We'll be back right after this.
This is WAMC CEO Sarah Gilbert. It's a pivotal time for public media, as you know, and we're using this opportunity to hear from members of our loyal, lovely audience about why they value our work, in their own words. Here's David Gustina.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm here with Dave Dalal. Dave, how long have you been listening to WAMC?
I've been listening to WAMC since I moved to the area in 2016.
That's quite a long time now, and why public radio? Why WAMC?
Public radio provides a service that I think commercial radio doesn't, with just providing news and facts without having to worry about any sort of bottom line or any sort of special interests or anything like that. I just get to hear about what's happening nationally, locally, internationally, and I know I'm going to get unbiased information. And, you know, WAMC, because, you know, the local programming to go along with that, you know, the roundtable, the panel, Vox Pop, these are all shows that provide sort of more context, more, you know, information to understand what's going on. But then also with like something like Vox Pop, you know, a little bit of cultural and life help.
Thank you so much for listening and for being part of our community. You can keep it all going with a pledge at WAMC.org.
You heard her, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. It's Listener Appreciation Week, and we love you. We know, I hope you know how much we love you. Look, WAMC listeners have always been there for us over the many, many years that we have been on the air, you know, as we close in on 50, I believe. That people have always been with us and have always had our back. And now at this time where things are precarious, where things I believe are dangerous, then I do believe that as many people as possible who can help us and support us is really necessary. So a lot of people ask, you know, what can we do? Well, what you can do is you can help us, you can support us, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. And then the group aspect of this is tell your friends, talk to your family, and say, WAMC really needs you, and bring them into the tent as well. We do love you. We thank you so much for everything that you've done over the years. You know, I've been here a long time, and we've talked about this for a long time, and it's the fact that we always need you, and you always are with us, and we're always concerned about what our future is. And I've made this case for decades on this station, which is this is all very fragile. There's an on and off switch. You can turn it on, you can turn it off. And if you turn it off, which seems to be, if you take the funding away, that's where you want it to be. It's not where it's going to be. It's not where it has to be. But it's what seems to be the end goal by many. So we've been talking about this sort of in the abstract, and now real language is coming out, and is we're being told what is happening and what action is being taken that greatly impacts public media. So whatever you can do to help us, WAMC.org, WAMC.org, we would love to hear from you. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC.
Right. You know, I like this friends and family approach because it does more than try to expand the base of contributors. Maybe it expands the audience, too, because I always talk to people who are unaware of what WAMC does and the programs it's offered. So I think having those conversations with your friends and your family is a good idea.
I always assume that none of my family listens, and then I'll make some, you know, offhanded comment about my brother, and then my brother will call up and say, what was that about? Thank you.
Well, you know, you made the point during the anniversary celebration last week. And by the way, congratulations on 25 years of the Roundtable.
Thank you. It only seems like 22.
But you made the point that outside of the Midday Magazine, was it between 1 and 2?
1 and 2.
Essentially, it's all local programming for the entirety of the day. And tell me how many public radio stations this size or even larger can claim that. There's just a significant amount of content on this station, the WAMC, that is not available on other NPR stations and certainly not available on commercial radio.
Our founder, Dr. Alan Chartok, who founded this station, and there are many brilliant things that he did, but in my mind, the two most brilliant things that he did, one is just that, have us not to be reliant on NPR or programming from other NPR-like services, whether it be APM or PRX or dot, dot, dot. And so that we, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and then even in the evenings, that's all of our own program, with the exception of the 1 o'clock hour, as you mentioned. That is really important because when this happens, that we were on our own before. We're not as reliant on the network because we're off doing our own thing. Which our audience has reacted to and has supported over these many years. The other thing that Alan has done with great brilliance and over many, many years, and we just try to keep that going, is building a community, building this incredible community by adding stations, by adding by talking about different issues, of having the geographic reach that the station has, and to make sure that people know that it's all in. And one of the most important parts of that is that you don't have to give $50 or $100 or whatever. There's no set amount to become a member. Whatever you give, whatever you do, if you pick up the phone, if you talk, if you call us, you can be a member of the radio station. And that there's safety in that numbers, that you're growing those friends and family because you are you're building up this life force that has the station, is at the station's back and is ready to move into the future. So here we are, and it's a really important time. But yes, Ira, I agree with you. It's really something that is incredible to think about, of the amount of programming that we do and what we're responsible for. And I think we say this all the time during our fund drives, for someone to find that one thing that they can't live without, the one thing that they rely on, that one thing that they need to get through their day, of whether it be a weather forecast or the panel or a newscast, that you take it, you support it, and you make sure that it's like adopting a highway. Without the potholes.
Joe, can I ask you one question? Is this the greatest existential threat to the station that you've seen in your 25 plus years?
I would need so much more therapy to properly answer that question, I think.
You had the state Pataki threatened to
Pataki threat, which was just bizarre because it was like they carved us out. It was every radio station except for WAMC, like, was safe, and then we weren't. But that one was almost like an easy fight because you're like, well, that's not fair. And then our listeners came and you know, were like, yeah, that's not fair. And then it was changed. But yes, I think for if we separate WAMC from public media as a whole, you know, I think we keep saying, like, we're going through a tough time. It's going to be a tough time, and it'll be a challenge, but a challenge that I think we can overcome. And because we have such an incredible listenership. So in that case, I would answer no to your question. To public broadcasting as a whole and smaller rural stations throughout this country that don't have original programming from 9 until 4 p.m. and rely on a network that is going to be severely cut, I do think that is a great crisis that is going to could, if all of this goes through, silence those stations, number one. And number two, make it whereas Judy, in your business, Ira too, but
News Deserts.
News Deserts, yeah.
Right, and it comes at a time when all media is facing increased pressure. I mean, there are other ways you can get information. We're under attack. People attack our credibility. Small town radio stations probably don't have the underwriting support that they used to because the small town businesses have gone out of business. So it's a challenge for all levels of media, even without the threat of withdrawal of federal funding that the public media broadcast stations face at this point. It was challenging to begin with. It's become more challenging. But my message always is, we are not dying. Media is not dying because then you have a defeatist attitude. Mm-hmm. You have to say, yeah, we're here. We'll always be here. We're not going anywhere. It's a challenge, but we will overcome it. And I think that's the approach that public media is taking at this point.
I think historically, there's example after example of the quickest path to tyranny is by taking control of media. And so the first step on that is reduction of funding, right? You have to be able to pay for it, for this sort of thing. So I'm deeply worried that it's a chipping away. And as I said, the quickest step towards tyranny is that.
And the other thing is, it's one of several actions. One of the other actions is the investigation by the FCC into what is a commercial versus what is an underwriting announcement. And then saying that if you are running commercials, then why do you need public funding? So there's that. That's under investigation by the FCC, and something else that could certainly take a crack at us. And then more recently, the news that three members of the CPB, Corporation for Public Broadcasting Board, were axed. And also, I would just add one more thing. Which is that, you know, in the public, all of this is going on. And so for us in public media, it's like, yeah, this is a huge deal. Like, this is, you know, this is where we live. This is it. But then with all the other stuff, it's hard to go out and say, well, give us all your money. And I know there's also that USAID thing, like there's a USAID thing. You know, there's like you suddenly are competing with other things that are vital and important. The argument, and I don't even know if argument is really the word, but what I would say is you won't even know about that stuff if there isn't an independent media that is out there who is reporting on it. So
send money.
WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Rich did.
Thank you for indulging us in this conversation, Joe.
Thank you.
We wanted to talk about it.
Thank you very much. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. All right. Let's go on to other topics and speak about things that are of great importance even to Rich. Okay, so we go to...
is this number 12 or 11?
Yes, that's right. 10, 11, 12. Okay, so I do want to talk about the Tyre Nichols story out of Memphis, Tennessee. And this is former Memphis police officers found not guilty in this killing. This story is something that goes back a bit, a ways, since the 2023 beating death of Tyre Nichols that helped galvanize a movement to reform police conduct. The jurors in the case deliberated for more than 8 hours after listening to days of testimony that delved into the minutes after police pulled over Nichols for a traffic stop. And when the 29-year-old FedEx worker was repeatedly hit and kicked by the officers, the verdict is a blow for police reform advocates who hoped a guilty verdict would motivate support for their efforts. But supporters of the officers said that they were following police procedure and that the prosecution was driven by public outcry. Prosecutors argued that the former officers had a duty to protect Nichols, but became angry when he fled after being pulled over. Attorneys for the men warned jurors that a conviction would hurt law enforcement's ability to aggressively pursue suspects in a violent city. The officers hugged their attorneys and each other after the verdict was read. Hallelujah. Thank you, Jesus. A family member of one of the former officers repeatedly shouted after leaving the courtroom. All of the former officers involved in the beating are black, as was Nichols.
Should that have been the last sentence or the first sentence?
Well, it was my last sentence.
No,
it was
I understand.
Not the last
sentence of the article. I guess my point is that there was not the immediate, what we've come to see over in past verdicts that went in favor of police, there was not the immediate outcry or demonstration, and I'm wondering how much of that is because the cops are all black.
Do we know what the jury makeup was also racially?
And they
I was looking for it. I couldn't immediately find it.
I did find it, and now I don't remember what. I mean, obviously it was mixed, but I don't completely remember what the jury makeup was.
So if the defense is they were following police procedure, then clearly they need to reevaluate the police procedure. I think one of the things the Department of Justice has historically done is gone into communities where there have been allegations of police misconduct, reviewed the procedures, and called for the institution of better procedures so these kinds of things don't happen. You know, earlier I was talking about how you have to respect the judicial process, whether or not you agree with things or not. And so in that respect, you have to respect what's happening. I think that some of these officers involved in the incident had pled guilty already. And then there had been convictions at the federal level.
Yeah, there were federal charges of witness tampering or obstruction of justice as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's truly a very sad case. You have to wonder, you know, they were pursuing him for, I think, a minor traffic infraction, but he took off. And perhaps he took off because he was afraid of being, you know, of people of color are often afraid of being stopped by police because they've seen these instances where, you know, they can get treated badly. You know, I've seen instances where police officers have been very, very good at trying to tamp down a situation, to mediate, and very kind to people. But I have seen the opposite as well. I can tell you the opposite I see very far less frequently. So I think officer training needs to be involved. I think that needs to be the discussion at this point.
I was surprised about the outcome of this one, not just because of the fact that the video is so dramatic and so horrifying, but also because there's the reform movement is still prominent, maybe not as prominent as it was 5 years ago, but it's still pretty prominent. So I was surprised about this one. And I think, if I can, I think there's the broader issues of the criminal justice system are worth mentioning here, right? That is, I'll mention, and I'll defer to Rich on this one because I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, the difference between state courts and federal courts in and of itself, right, is going to perhaps produce a different outcome than you might expect. Secondly, there's the criminal justice system is racist, and I understand that the defendants were black in this particular case. But at the end of the day, there's been this kind of systematic way in which African-American young men like Tyree have been targeted in a way that's in the criminal justice system that's difficult. You have things like the war on drugs in the Reagan administration. You've got the broken windows theory that comes up in the Giuliani in the 90s and the 2000s. Michelle Alexander, I'll stop here, but Michelle Alexander has this phenomenal book in which she talks about what's called the New Jim Crow, right? This way in which elites have kept young black men incarcerated in the as a way of controlling a particular population. Our criminal justice system is broken in lots of ways. Police reform is a component of that. But at the end of the day, there's complications that are beyond just this individual case.
So what I have been able to find is the jury will consist of 2 black men, 4 black women, 2 Asian men, 4 white men, 4 white women.
That's a big jury.
Yeah, how many was that?
So a 12-person jury was selected along with four alternates.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right. That's the information that I
did have. They move the trial to another jurisdiction?
Chattanooga, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So there is that. Anybody else on that? Okay, let me just check for letters. And if none, we will go on to other topics. We have this from Helen. On immigration, the reason that all claims are being presented as asylum claims is because the normal legal route to immigration has been largely cut off for decades. We need immigration in the ordinary course, but the last immigration bill was during the Reagan administration. I'm no fan of W, but he did actually organize and promote a bipartisan immigration reform bill, which was torpedoed by a relatively small group of conservatives within his own party. Stabbed in the back by his own party, that's when Republicans learned that this was a good issue for them to demagogue and that it was toxic to address in a serious way. And here we are. The conversation shouldn't be limited to asylum claims, but how much regular immigration we actually want and need. Then we go to Roger, who says one of the most dangerous of Trump's comments concerns not ruling out military intervention in Greenland, though no such threat against Canada. With all yes men and chaos now at the Pentagon, how likely might such action happen along with war with a NATO country? Why is this being tolerated? Then we go to a letter from Carl, who writes, I'm a Swedish citizen, been in the United States on a green card for decades. I've always felt safe, but now I'm considering the possibility of being deported to El Salvador. Really? My closest friends have instructions that if I were to disappear, contact my consulate general and embassy. The best I can do, it is chilling, and such is their strategy. And that is from Carl. And I think that is it for the letters I have in front of me. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. panel@wamc.org. Rich has to go. Rich has a day job and needs to leave us. So thank you. Not that you all know.
I don't have a day job.
But thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Always a pleasure. Great to see everybody.
Nice
great
thank you very you, much. We'll continue. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll go to a couple more stories, and we'll take it to the top of the hour. Judy Patrick, Ira Fussfeld, and Bo Breslin with us this morning. And again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A few messages and a news update from the BBC. I do enjoy the fact that during the break, I just realized this, and I said, because Ira said, so what are we going to go to next? And I said, let's talk about Newark.
Nothing to do with the airport. And I just talk about Newark.
I realized of just the great joy I had in that of talking about Newark. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Rich Honan had to go, but we have Bo Breslin, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick with us. We'll be going right up till noon today, and 11 o'clock today. Sorry, panel, not to give you
project without us.
No, so I know.
Get out of here on time.
I know. I felt
I
when
could
we
stick
were
around.
Yeah, there you go. Bo's in. Thank you, Bo. When we were talking about earlier about public media, I felt like, oh, this is a great rehearsal for the media project. Ira and Judy doing their
after
thing.
After decades, we still need to rehearse.
You always need to rehearse. Not you, just in general, me. Us. Okay, let's go to Newark, New Jersey, and we are talking about fight issues that have been going on for a really long time. On a recent afternoon in Philadelphia, an air traffic controller began shouting that he had lost his radar feed for planes flying in and out of Newark Liberty International Airport. That seems concerning, right? Some of his colleagues still had radar, but their radios went dead, prompting frantic calls to their counterparts in New York, urging them to keep their planes away from the airspace of Newark. Then, for 30 harrowing seconds until the radios came back on, there was nothing more to do but hope, as they had no means of telling pilots how to avoid crashing their planes into one another. Shortly after that, one controller discovered a trainee who had been directing Newark traffic under supervision just moments earlier, shaking in the hallway. I know there's nothing funny about this story, and yet, oh my God. That was the chaotic scene on Monday, April 28th, according to several people who were present, when controllers working the airspace for Newark lost the means to do their jobs. The failure of the system the controllers rely on left several of those on duty that day with extreme anxiety, requiring a mental health respite that caused low staffing levels for days since. It has also prompted more than 1,000 flights at one of the nation's busiest airports to be canceled or delayed, leaving some passengers feeling frustrated and, quite frankly, abandoned. If you look at the departure sign that was just even from yesterday, it is filled with delays, some rather short, some very long, and others that are just canceled altogether. The struggles with staffing are particularly notable because the Federal Aviation Administration's decision to relocate some of the Newark air traffic control operations to Philadelphia last summer was intended to increase the headcount. The nation's air traffic control system has been plagued by years of dysfunction. The controller ranks were depleted by retirements and a cessation in training during the pandemic. Since then, recruiting and certifying new controllers had been difficult. Existing controllers have been fatigued and even sickened by intense stress and long hours, according to the New York Times. Some have avoided seeking medical attention because doing so could jeopardize the health care clearances they need to do the work. Turnover is frequent, especially amid illnesses, family turmoil, or safety scares. The outage and its after effects at Newark have prompted public outrage. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who oversees the FAA, has called for a brand new air traffic control system. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the minority leader, has said the FAA is really a mess. Scott Kirby, the chief executive of United Airlines, which is Newark's biggest user, said the airport, quote, cannot handle the number of planes that are scheduled to operate there, and blame controllers who, quote, walked off the job. But current and former controllers who requested anonymity for fear of retaliation and people who witnessed last week's outages said the controllers' time away from their duties was appropriate under the circumstances. A long lead into that, but a lot of information there to give you the overall sense that it sounds like just a mess.
So the lowly political scientist here, and I'm curious about asking the three of you as media experts a question about this, because it is true, and I would sort of date it back, Joe, to maybe the 737 MAX problems of a decade ago,
right.
That, you know, attention paid to everything from air traffic safety to air traffic controllers to Newark and so on seems to have ratcheted up in the media. We're paying either more attention to it, or we're, as media folks, we're able to get the stories a little bit more. I'm assuming that some of this stuff happened before. So the question is, to what extent are we better as media outlets in finding these stories and getting to the source of it? And to what extent should we really be nervous that we're getting on planes?
I think the problem at Newark, there had been something similar that happened a year ago. So that was one of the, I think that's increases the news value of the story because it seems to be an ongoing problem that hasn't been fixed. Part of it is Americans' fascination with air travel. The idea that more people are traveling now than a generation ago. I mean, almost everybody travels, and almost everybody encounters the stress of being in an airport and having your flight canceled or delayed. A lot of places have aviation consultants. I noticed that the Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy, is going to come out today with a plan to renovate or upgrade the IT systems that the air traffic controllers use and to increase the number of air traffic controllers. I remember this being an issue in the Reagan administration. Remember when they went on a strike and he fired a lot of them. So it's I think America has long had a fascination with air travel, less so with train travel. There have been many times when I've been sitting at an airport waiting for a delayed flight that I wish that we had a train that would have taken me where I needed to go, more efficiently than the air traffic system does. These stories, people are interested in, and I think the Newark one got more play in part because it was on the East Coast. I think if it had happened maybe on the West Coast, less play. And it's also one of the nation's busiest airports.
Well, that's right. It's one of the busiest airports. I will say that one of the things that I thought in the coverage to answer to sort of both your points was when I first heard about this story, I thought it was a one-off, that it was this is what happened over the weekend. And what I didn't realize was the severity and for how long it had been going on. And then that brings into your question, Bo, of, why haven't we heard about this before? Right. It seems like
exactly.
And certainly the recounting of that story of April 28th, where there is just, almost a minute of chaos of knowing where things are in the sky.
It's not like they can look out a window because they're not there. They're at a different place in a dark room just looking at a screen.
I mean, I've been in a dark room in Philadelphia, and it can be scary.
Well, I don't know. I don't even know where to start. I would not necessarily in order of importance. I would question whether or not the airlines, either out of greed or out of the sense of duty or both, there are too many planes in the sky at any one time. It's interesting that United canceled 35 round trip flights out of Newark because I think that they ostensibly because they knew that they were going to be late. And or canceled, so why even start booking them? But I think in part to respond to what Bro wrote, the line about air traffic in this country, rightly so apparently, was it was the safest mode of transportation. You were a lot safer getting on an airplane than you were getting in your car and getting on the thruway. And then the crash at Reagan happened. And then they had a couple of other incidents similar to some involving small planes, but I believe there was one other large plane. And until then, the media was not reporting on something because it was just business as normal and things were going great. And since the Reagan incident, I believe there have been. It seems to me that there are more reporters looking more closely at the air traffic business, and they're uncovering things like the lead-in that Joe had before about the technical problems. It's one thing to say there are too many planes in the sky. There's another to say that the equipment is so bad that they were without contact for 90 seconds.
Have you ever listened to those radio transmissions that they play about a plane landing? I never can understand
that.
Yeah,
no.
It's really complicated.
They need a better form of voice communication, and there's got to be that's got to be available in this day and age.
Well, as long as they all understand it, right?
Yeah, it must be. No wonder it takes years of training to understand, amid the crackling and the static.
I will say, I know, I don't know how many other airports do this, but Albany used to do it, where it's under construction now, but renovation. But up on the top, there's the art gallery, and then in the front of that, you could overlook, and pumped in was the were the voices of air traffic control of. You could hear what was going on. I always found it to be fascinating. You're right. I didn't always understand it. You know, I would just wish they say, you know, the green plane, and then I would be, you know, better off.
Keep it simple.
No, right. Yeah, the big green thing coming in is landing now. But it is fascinating. But I understand the point. It's hard to keep track of it all. What I wonder is, does it have an effect, and it does it have an effect on how many people will travel in the future and how concerned, and going on with the other stories of people who are not going internationally or not leaving the country because of other concerns that are taking place?
Yeah, I think the projection is that there's going to be a pretty sizable decrease in travel over the next 12 months.
It already has happened because of the economy.
Yeah, starting to go down. And I think this doesn't help. I worry about the airlines. They're a big economic driver. And, you know, Southwest is struggling, and Southwest has always been great. So I think there's a cascading effect here that will have ramifications at least for the next couple of years.
Yeah, and I think we all have our favorite airports, like or airports we avoid. I try to avoid Chicago because of the weather, because it seems like everything. Yeah. And if you talk to anybody who travels a lot, they'll say, yeah, this is a great airport. This is usually reliable. I love the rocking chairs at
BWI,
yeah.
The best.
BWI has rocking chairs. Charlotte has rocking chairs. Yeah. I will say, though, and I don't know how you all feel. Maybe you disagree with me, but I will say that when I travel around, when I get back to the Albany Airport, I love that airport. It's great. Know what they're going to do to it. I don't know what's afoot there, but I love that airport. I just wish all airports were like the Albany Airport.
Because you can shoot out in like a minute and a half.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like you go through security, you go right, you go left, you go straight.
Exactly.
Done.
Right.
And people are friendly. They have dogs running around, the healing dogs, and that's great. And I don't know. I love
you know
airport.
The controller doesn't have a lot of planes in the air he's got to worry about, or she.
And I know it's my hometown airport, but I have great fondness that when I'm going through that airport, I'm like, oh, I wish every airport was like this.
And I love it. Agreed. When you land and they'll say, welcome to Albany, but sometimes the flight attendant does not know how to
say Albany.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you want to correct them, quite frankly. We'll take a break and we'll finish up on the other side of this short break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Bo Breslin, and Judy Patrick left. They're the survivors. They're the ones who've made it through the whole show, and hopefully you have as well. WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you as we finish up the program on this Thursday morning. And I have to get both Judy and Ira out of the studio soon because they have to go do the media project. So we started talking about the new Pope and the conclave. 133 cardinals sequestered in the Sistine Chapel, voting for a new leader of the Catholic Church. The faithful and just curious are gathered in St. Peter's Square. I believe for the third time this morning, the black smoke went up, which was an indicator that a pope had not been selected, and there is supposed to be another selection process within the next hour or two. It is a highly secret voting system that began inside what is possibly one of the world's most secure vaults in the early evening, with the 133 cardinals tasked to decide who will succeed Pope Francis, writing candidates' names on voting cards by hand, trying to disguise their handwriting. Outside in St. Peter's Square, thousands of the faithful, the curious, and vacationing gathered to await the news of whether the cardinals had managed to elect a papal successor. Word came at 9 p.m. last night in the form of black smoke billowing from a chimney installed last week on the roof of the chapel, which I did not know, a new chimney.
Yes, so they installed a new chimney.
A new chimney. So that's good.
They got it from Amazon.
If this
with the tariff.
If the smoke had been white, it would have meant that the cardinals had chosen the new pope. And a dozen, the first new pope in a dozen years, and just one round of voting, a feat not seen for centuries. There have since been two more votes. And so we continue to await. And it is momentous. We were talking about this earlier, but just thinking about that whole idea of how secretive something like this is, we're not used to that. There's always, there's always been leaking and on other issues and things that we don't know about. And yet, here we go. Like, I always think of things, I'm not comparing the two. Please do not think I'm comparing the two. But even when you have things like the Academy Awards, who's going to win Best Picture, inevitably some reporter will go out and find the 150 people who cast votes and say, who did you vote for? And maybe 100 will say yes. Then they'll use the odds and say, all right, chances are it's going to be this. You don't even have that here at all. There's some speculation. There's front runners. There's people that speculate. But they so often get it wrong.
Right.
I think mostly get it wrong.
So you don't believe that at the end of the vote, when the new pope is installed, that someone who was defeated in the vote will not claim it was rigged?
No. I don't know that. Yeah.
No, we don't know that.
Yeah. The times have changed. I'm not sure. But that's a very good point. Right.
Cardinal Dolan is a close friend of Trump. So, you never can be sure.
Never know what's going to happen. And just a reminder, it took 2 days to elect Pope Francis in 2013 and Pope Benedict in 2005. No conclave in the 20th or 21st centuries has lasted more than 5 days. So if you're over there now, you got a pretty good shot.
Yeah.
The news coverage of this has been substantial. And I think in some ways it reminds us or serves as a reminder to us of the role of the Catholic Church. Oftentimes in the U.S., we just often think of it, I think 20% of Americans will identify as Catholic. But in the Southern Hemisphere especially, it's a growing faith. And the importance of the Pope gets underscored at this point. And I think that's one of the important reasons to cover this. And it doesn't happen very often. The secrecy is part and parcel of the process. But again, it's almost been wall-to-wall coverage of this. I understand the camera's been focused on a seagull that's sitting on top of the chimney. I think that gets ridiculous at some point. But these larger...
I miss the seagull story.
The
larger discussions about the church, where it will be headed, what it sees as its mission, and, the people who... It counts as its faithful is an important thing for us to hear about at this point.
And riffing off that, what Judy just said, Joe, what I'm most interested in? I have to put my political science hat back on. So to what extent do the cardinals see their choice, primarily about the direction of the church, but not only as a reflection on the church, but also a ballast for right-wing populism in Europe, especially.
Yes.
You're getting a ton of right-wing, countries like Giorgia Meloni in Italy herself is a right-wing populist, or Sweden, Hungary, Germany, the new guy who just got in yesterday is a right-wing populist. So, I wonder, and politics has always been part of the Catholic Church, right? Thomas More lost his head because of it. So I'm just curious to what extent the cardinals, we'll probably never know, but I'm curious to what extent the cardinals are thinking about that ballast. The other thing I'll throw in the mix is that India and China, 1.4 billion people, each of those, The Catholic Church is itself 1.4 billion people. So
right.
at the end of the day, they see, I have to believe the cardinals see themselves as having a some sort of political role in this largely right-wing populist world that we're in.
And ultimately, when you think about, we're almost out of time, but I was thinking about this last night, that, I mean, you look at our U.S. Senator, our Congress, and of representing people, 1.3 billion Catholics,
yeah.
133 cardinals. I mean, it's not that many people who are representing that many,
yeah.
that many Catholics and that many regions, that many areas, which is really stunning when you think about it. Yeah.
And not a woman among them.
And not a woman among them. And I'm sure that the folks who are trying to herd these cats are all saying to themselves, "Wow, 133 is a lot." But when you look at it in the terms of the globe, it just doesn't seem like it's that many people. We'll see. Maybe by tomorrow morning on this program, there will be a new pope. We will see. My thanks to Bill Breslin, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. And again, thanks to Rich Honan. You all are wonderful.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Go forth and do the Media Project. We will be back after this.